Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, speaking from his post on the observation deck in Andalusia, Spain. It is Wednesday, September 5th, 2012. This would be Nav Briefing 22, and I'm giving it the title Moral Anarchy. It's been some time since I reported in my last Nav Briefings, and my messages from the mailroom were recorded when I was up in Belgium at the end of July and the beginning of August. So, that's nearly a month now since you've heard from me. I didn't intend it to be that way, and I know these lapses must cause you some concern and puzzlement, not to mention perhaps some discouragement. After all, we are living this Gaian navigation experiment in real time, moment by moment, day by day. And the main objective of this experiment is to stay current with the momentous developments that we are tracking. As for my part, I just want to reassure you that I always report when I can. And when I can't, well, I don't. Either because I don't have anything to say, or I'm incapable of putting what I do see and know into language. Just in case you're wondering, I am quite well. No health problems, I'm not ill, but I am, in a way, incapacitated and relatively numb. And I would describe what I've been feeling in the past month since you've heard from me as a condition of profound fatigue. Now, I don't know exactly what is the cause of this fatigue. Over the past year and a half or so, I've been tracking a rough correlation between my vitality and my morale and the impact of massive coronal emissions. I think some of you have been following these correlations as well. Now, I can't say absolutely or with any certainty that there is a direct relationship, but the correlation, which I would call tentative, is pretty convincing in some ways. Now, I've pointed out that in Gaian terms, and as regards the myths, as regards the designs and purposes of the divine Sophia, the planetary animal mother is collaborating closely with the sun with the intention of bleaching out a certain kind of mold in the petri dish of the terrestrial laboratory. That mold specifically is the mold of the human element. It is a mold that has spread through the realm of nature, that is to say, the habitat, the laboratory setting where humans live, along with all the other species. The mold that has spread through that habitat is carried and propagated through human animals. It's kind of like, you could say, an infection, a kind of leprosy. If you could imagine that a great majority of the human herd on the planet, of the current 6.5, going on 7 billion, a great majority of these individual animals of the herd are carrying a mold, which is a kind of leprosy, but you would also have to call it maybe a moral leprosy. I'll have to talk a little more about what I mean by this word moral, since it figures in the title of this briefing. So I've spoken of this bleaching out process and connected that directly with the benevolent role that the sun is playing as a living being of a quasi-aeonic intelligence, but an inorganic or semi-organic constitution. The role it is playing in collaboration with the divine Sophia as she proceeds with the initial conditions of her correction. And I'm not beyond proposing to you that if this is true, if this mythopoetic cosmological proposition is true, then all human animals would be feeling it. And I think this is part of what I have been feeling, certainly. I have a deep exhaustion that just seems to be bottomless. And it's almost a numbing exhaustion. It numbs motivation. It doesn't numb my mind. It doesn't make me stupid or somnolent. I don't walk around like a zombie. I retain my awareness. I retain my acute sensibility and vulnerability, which are sometimes unbearably intense. But on a moral and a physical level, simultaneously, I feel totally wiped out, and this is the way I've felt during the interval of time of nearly a month since I just spoke to you, since I last spoke to you, excuse me. Now, just to put things into physical perspective, it's going on 6 a.m. here in the morning. It's totally dark. I'm sitting outside on the upper terrace. As I look straight across due southeast, I see the beacon of Sirius pretty much at eye level where I view it from my terrace. Sirius has risen, following the cartwheeling figure of Orion, which rises well before dawn in these autumn skies. And to the left of Sirius, tracing horizontally along the horizon to about due east, to the area where the actual ecliptic constellations are rising, I see Venus. So Venus is up, and high, high above Venus, Jupiter stands almost exactly between the star Aldebaran in the eye of the bull and the star Elnat, which is at the horn tip of the bull, the upper horn tip. Elnat, you will recall, is a star shared also by the constellation of Auriga, the charioteer. And way above Jupiter, now approaching the zenith, is the Pleiades. So what I'm looking at is the extended version of the pleromic relay spindle, the extended version. The way that the spindle is configuring itself as relay is being established here on Earth, the relay between the galactic center and the Earth, is that the relay is uncoiling itself like a collapsible antenna. At the first moment of its of inception of relay, which was back, you know, when Jupiter reached the Pleiades and Venus was nearby, having completed her retrograde cycle by backing up to meet Jupiter. At that moment, you could say that the relay device of the spindle was like a coil, like an antenna coil, and that what has been happening as relay is effectuated is that that coil has been stretched and the antenna has been stretched. And now it has two parts. The upper part consists of a large transmitting coil, I would say, a large transmitting coil with its apex at the Pleiades and the span of the spiraling coil defined by the distance between Aldebaran and Elnat, with Jupiter floating exactly in the center of that spiral antenna device. The lower part of the relay, which might be considered the receiving part, because the relay allows both transmission from and to the galactic center, the lower part is extremely interesting to observe. As I'm looking right now, I see, of course, Sirius, as I said, and to the left of it I see Venus. But actually there's another bright light positioned between the two of them. And as Venus is dropping down, that is moving forward in the order of the zodiac, it's forming within a day or two an exact alignment with Sirius and Procyon. And so there is a configuration sort of horizontal along the southeastern horizon of two stars and a planet, Sirius to the left, Procyon, and finally Venus. Now this is an extremely interesting alignment to consider. I can't tell you exactly what this alignment means, but I would point out, of course, the importance of Sirius as the brightest star in the sky, with a great deal of interesting mythology attached to it. Whether it be the mythology of the Dogons connected with Sirius as initially revealed to the world by my old colleague Robert Temple, my old London buddy Robert Temple, when he wrote The Sirius Mystery. Also, there's a lot of cat mythology and feline mythology connected with Sirius. The idea that there is a race of cat people on Sirius and that the felines of the earth are somehow connected with Sirius. An extremely interesting material here. But when you go to look at Procyon, Procyon is a very obscure star. It's the brightest star in Canis Minor, the little dog. And curiously, in all the years that I've looked at the sky, I've never been able to arrive at a satisfactory concept or theme or mytheme or motif regarding Procyon. But I think the time has come for that to occur. So anyway, I'm looking right now at Procyon, and when you scan from right to left, you would scan from Sirius to Procyon, and then about half that distance again to Venus. And Venus is a little high in the alignment. It's going to drop down into exact alignment, and that will occur in 2 to 3 days. Well, you know what happens in 2 to 3 days. The event we've all been awaiting with bated breath, as the expression goes. On the 7th of September 2012, the aphelion of the moon, the apogee of the moon, reaches the Pleiades, with Jupiter positioned about 16 degrees beyond the Pleiades. And right now, the moon, in its waning phase, is almost directly in the zenith of my position. I can't see it because I'm sitting under the shade of the upper terrace, but if I stepped out, it would be right there overhead. The moon is waning. It's called the gibbous moon. It has kind of a lopsided face. And it's moving toward its apogee in conjunction with the Pleiades. And that moment, September 7th, followed shortly thereafter by, on the 8th, by the occultation of Jupiter by the moon. That moment, 7-8 September, is the moment of the completion of the entire dynamical 21-point relay system from the Earth to the Pleroma. Now that's galactic alignment. And that is an event to be observed, an event to be tested. It's not a theory about galactic alignment that I've been propagating in this GNE. It's not just a theory. It is a mytho-poetic proposition reflected in astronomical reality and in terrestrial reality. And its reflection in the realm of the human psyche, both individual and collective, remains to be seen. Following this development from the 7th and 8th of September onward is sure to be the most dramatic and the most challenging part of the Gaian navigation experiment. Now, I want to emphasize to all of you two points. I want to register in your minds two realizations of the utmost importance. In the first place, as members of the Gaian navigation experiment, you are witnesses to the Nahual of the Wisdom Goddess. You are witnesses to the supernatural power of the planetary animal mother. But what kind of witnesses are you? You know that it's a truism in the realm of forensics and crime, an investigation of crime, that eyewitness accounts of events are the least reliable evidence and are viewed with great caution in legal argument. It is a magnificent opportunity to be an eyewitness account of the supernatural power of the Wisdom Goddess. But what kind of an eyewitness are you? You could be witnessing it. It could be all around you. It could be running through you. And you might not even notice it. And if you did notice it, you might have a distorted interpretation of what's happening to you. So I want to say this not to discourage you, but in fact to encourage you. Simply by reassuring you that this has never happened before. No one has ever done an experiment like this before. And you gain the faculties to be her eyewitness through the experiment. You do not come into the experiment with those faculties. You could even say that the power of her Nahual operates in you to engender the faculties to witness it. Now live by that principle. Don't believe it. Don't take it as a principle of faith. And it is not an act of faith. It is simply an experimental proposition. The Wisdom Goddess engenders in her witnesses the faculties to observe what she is doing as she does it. None of you at the beginning of this experiment were prepared for what you will witness. And what you will witness and how deeply you will go into her Nahual, what you will feel, see, and know to be permanently registered in you for the rest of your life is also part of the unknown, but it is not part of the unknowable. So I point you back there to a very important distinction that Don Juan made in his conversations with Carlos Castaneda. The Nawal knows what is the unknown, and the unknown can be explored, and it can become known. Then there is the unknowable, which cannot be known. I don't know if we've been facing the unknowable during this past month. In some respects, I feel that I have, and perhaps you've had the same impression. As the completion of Relay ticks down to the final moment, I have had an experience again and again that my consciousness is rebuffed, that I've been thrown back as if by a wave. You know, the Nawal exploring the Nawal is sort of like a surfer. I think it was Jose Arguelles who first made that meme popular, talking about surfing the wave that comes out of the galactic center in his fantasia of galactic alignment. But you know, the shaman is like a surfer on the waves of beauty of this planet. And I have always had the opportunity and the privilege to surf from one wave to the next, and to surf onto higher and higher and ever more powerful waves. Lately, I can't do that. Lately, I have more the impression over this last month that I am being thrown back by the wave. I get in the curl, as a surfer would say. I'm in the curl, but the curl brings me down. I don't go over the crest of the wave. I'm just in the curl. And I think this is where we've all been in this last month during the completion of Pleromic Relay. It has been really difficult to tell what's going on and to even stay with the mood of her power. To even follow the mood of the Dakini shifts has been, nearly impossible. The Bhairavi shift ended on the 16th of August. We're now in the shift of Shodashi, or Tripura Sunduri, the beautiful one of the three realms. I can't read the mood of the shift. Although I did have initially a shamanic seance in the first day of the shift. And in the slightly altered consciousness of that seance with a collaborator here on the terrace, I was able to get some perceptions regarding Shodashi and regarding the role of beauty and the power of beauty in Sophia's correction. But by and large, I can't track anything right now, hardly at all. And maybe that is partly what has contributed to my sense of fatigue, almost bordering on futility, almost bordering on despair. And I have despaired. I have despaired over this last month. But I've not despaired over the beauty and wisdom of the planet. I've not despaired over the beauty and richness of my own life and yours, because your life and mine are the same life in her story. I just despaired over certain human individuals and the wretched, wretched self-betrayal of this species and the pettiness and shabbiness of the human heart that cannot open to the natural impulse of love. Over that I have despaired. And I must admit that despair has taken some toll on me and has had something to do with the lapse of time since you've heard from me. So how does the Tertan deal with despair? Well, I'll give you a little personal background on where I've been at over the last month. Don't usually talk about personal matters, but what the hell? It's such a beautiful morning here. And Venus is like a diamond on velvet off to my left, hanging over the eastern horizon, dropping down into that perfect alignment with Sirius and Procyon. There are great mysteries to be revealed by this alignment. And how am I dealing with my despair as I swim in all of the beauty of this setting where I live? Well, on the 8th of August, which is just about a couple of days after I got back from Brussels, I actually stopped eating for a while. And I thought I'd put it at around 21 days. The last time I did this was in the fall of 2009. And it was during a rare shift of Visvamata. I wrote about that shift in covering the Dakini cycles. And I wrote about reciprocity. And I think I may have explained how, at that time, I asked for a certain intervention. I talked about how the Dakinis hold knives and that they use the blade of the knife to cut away illusion. But on a rare occasion, if you know who your guardian Dakini is, you can ask her to use the butt of her knife to shatter the mirror of perception. And this is a really Nahualistic act of reckless bravery, because when that happens, it is exactly as if you're standing in front of a mirror and someone smashes it. And instead of seeing yourself and your life in a coherent image in the mirror, you see it break up into fragments. And that is exactly what happened to me as a result of that. And there were consequent losses in my life due to that. Situations that I could not return to and never wanted to return to. And at that time, I didn't eat for 18 days. So this time I did about 21. So that would have been to around the 28th or 29th of August, sometimes last week. Then I did eat a little. And I felt ill, actually. So I stopped. I realized that I had to continue. So I'm continuing. Right now, however, I'm drinking Heineken's. You know, tantricas are very strange in the way they eat and they drink. And their drinking habits and eating habits follow no rule except that which appeals in the moment. That means that I just do whatever I feel like doing, and I really don't feel like eating, and I could not eat for another 3 weeks. This is a peculiar thing. Have I lost a lot of weight? No. I lost about 10 pounds, maybe. I might lose 10 more. That wouldn't be so bad. I have a lot of inner resources to live off of. I have a fair amount of stored body fat. And I find that not eating gives me a great deal of strength. So this morning, I'm not eating. I will probably eat later today, very lightly, because of a particular occasion. This is something else that tantricas do. They eat to celebrate and for pleasure, but they do not eat to live. Right now, I'm celebrating the occasion of speaking to you. I won't always have this privilege, And I enjoy it hugely. And I'm having the breakfast of a Heineken as I watch the unfoldment of Pleromic Relay. There, you can hear me sipping. Sipping in the pre-dawn darkness in Andalusia. Now, things are happening in Andalusia, my friends. Things that reach right into the core of your life, your lives. And I have not said anything about these, even though the decisive event happened on the 3rd of August. Now, I have an announcement to make to the entire crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, as well as to all those engaged in Planetary Tantra, who are now engaged and who may be engaged in the future. And I'm watching very closely the moment of that announcement. I can tell you, and you know the Nawal is always a tease, don't ask me why I do this. It's not because I'm like teasing. It's simply because I, well, maybe I do, but it's simply because I need to be extremely cautious in making certain announcements when it concerns practical matters. Something has happened here, right where I live, very close to Infinity Ridge, that I would call an opportunity for gathering. Now, unless something happens to cancel this in the next 2 weeks, I'll announce what it is. And along with that, I will have the pleasure of telling you about 1, 2, 3, 4 other events. So 5 events of quite momentous significance in the Turton's life. The top event being something that I dreamed about, that I wished for, but that I won't say I never imagined it could happen. I tried to imagine many, many times how it could happen. I tried to imagine how this could happen and how I could offer something to all of you by way of a real event, a real place for an event, rather than simply in the course of my teachings and my navigational indications, you know, something concrete. Well, something concrete is manifested. And to me, it was extremely remarkable that it manifested during that interval of time in which Pleromic Relay was being established. Because during this interval, I've been asking myself the same question over and over again. I'm sure that many of you have also been asking this question. Once Pleromic Relay is operating, what difference is it going to make in my life? What difference is it going to make in my desires and in what I desire in life? What difference is it going to make in my dreams and how I would dream my life to unfold within her story, following her designs and purposes? That is the question, isn't it? It's a really selfish question, and it's a good selfish question. Can you realize the dream of your life in some way that was not possible before, once Pleromic Relay is operating, fully operating, and that's 3 days from when I'm speaking right now. And those of you who are listening to this talk, days afterward, months afterward, or years afterward, I propose that you take a deep breath and you hold that breath and register what I am saying and register what some people, doesn't matter how many, but what some people were witnessing and anticipating at this moment, looking out at the greater life of the planetary animal mother and looking in at their own lives at the same time. This is our finest moment of vigilance. And I do not predict, but I can tell you with great assurance and certainty, that changes in the way life happens after this relay can be as wild and magnificent and different from anything before as you dare to have it be, as you would dare to have it be. It can be that different. You know, in the last talk, I indicated the omen of the conjunction of Mars and Saturn close to the star Spica, and that was visible in the evening sky after sunset just a few weeks ago. During the remaining year and a half of correction, we're going to see Mars move forward into the scales to the scorpion, the snake tamer, and so forth. And Saturn will follow. And one of the main events that will happen in that part of the sky in the second half of correction is that Saturn will move into the constellation of the scales. Now, this is a remarkable omen in the celestial code. Look at how we have been trained so far to observe the erratic back and forth of the lunar perigee in the scales. We've had the scales on the brain now for quite some time, haven't we? The scales, the constellation of the balance. And we noted that there's a crazy pattern of a seesawing back and forth of perigee hits in the right and the left pans of the scales, and the decisive and crucial perigee hit August 23rd at the fulcrum of the scales. So during the first part of the experiment, we've been watching the perigee hits in the scales, but now the perigee hits are going to shift largely into the scorpion. But the planet Saturn will enter into the scales, and the planet Saturn will stand in the scales when the initial conditions of correction are completed. So I'd like to talk in the remainder of this NAB briefing about the coming event of Saturn in the scales. You could say, in a way, that the perigee hits in the scales that we've been observing, which represent, as you know, the actions of the first attention of the divine Sophia, operating upon the human mind, operating upon human behavior, and even down into the intricacies of our metabolic, physiological, and cellular processes. I would point out that among the events of this critical month of September 2012, we are anticipating the last perigee surge in the Virgin. That occurs on September 19th in 8 degrees of Scorpio. 8 degrees of Scorpio is the exact position of the last faint star that marks the extreme border of the composite stars of the Virgin, Lambda Virginis. And this star, Lambda Virginis, is, for reasons unknown, called the Alchemist's Star. Now, you will recall that we designate the perigee hits by the syntax of divine alchemy. There is one unique perigee hit concluding the series in the Virgin exactly at the location of Kambalia, the Alchemist's Star. This is coming up in about 2 weeks from today. And as I've suggested, this would be, in some manner, yet to be realized, the ultimate and supreme act of divine alchemy on the part of the Wisdom Goddess. I would say that it would be the moment when she completes the recalibration of the Anthropos, and that the new calibrated endowment of Anthropos 11 is completely perfect, because she begins with initial conditions that are perfect. That is the way an aeon works. By perfection, what I mean is not something that any human person could attain. This is a divine perfection. Divine perfection can be defined in a very simple way. It is the state of pure potentiality in which infinite potential perfectly fits the conditions for its expression. That is divine perfection. And every experiment begins in a state of divine perfection. So the experiment with Anthropos 11 begins on that date with that perigee hit. Now, with that said, let's look back for a moment at the last perigee hit, the crucial one that you were all waiting for, as I was, and that is the single hit of the lunar perigee in the fulcrum of the scales. Now, where was I? I mean, what was I saying? What was I doing? What should I have been doing? Would you think I should have been on the rooftops shouting out the significance of that perigee hit at the moment that it happened? It was on August 23rd. And I guess you might have wondered, what the hell is going on? We don't hear anything from John about this. And this is the moment that he's been setting us up for months now. Months! Well, remember that I said that there were two phases to establishing pleromic relay. The first phase was marked by these anomalies on the induction magnetometer, the 1400 anomaly, as it was called by the young gentleman who does suspicious observers. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, regularly, 2 o'clock universal time, there was an extreme disturbance in the overall magnetic configuration of the field of the Earth. And this was accompanied by remarkable acoustic effects. As I pointed out, in terms of this experiment, in terms of what's happening in the cosmos with our beloved Sophia, that was the moment of the log-on signal when she logged on to the incoming signal from the Pleroma. And it was a massive log-on because it involved running 21 plasma coils through the Pleromic spindle and directing them into the electromagnetic field of the Earth, grounding them in the Bima. Massive. So there was a massive log-on signal involved that went on for about 24 days. 24 to 34 days, something like that. Then you might have recalled that suspicious observers detected for a day or two a return of the 1400 anomaly. And I suggested to you that that was the law gone when Sophia began her upload. So you have Sophia uploading. And since Sophia has been uploading, I suggested that we were in a kind of radio silence. And I think there really is something to that, because I have been unable to get anything straight, and I have felt that my normal faculties have been in a way thwarted, and I haven't been able to formulate any concept or even an intuitive, inceptive notion of what is going to happen as soon as relay is completed. And right now, I'm telling you, right here this morning on the terrace, is the first time that I would even dare to suggest anything to you. But here it comes. This is a very generalized proposition that I'm giving you right now. And you should leave it generalized, but you might find in it some operative syntax that will prove to be helpful. How is life in this world, how is your life, and the conditions of your life in human society today going to be different after the completion of relay? The difference is already happening. The difference begins to happen after the fulcrum hit. What does the fulcrum hit signify? Well, in mytho-poetic imagery, it signifies a hit at the center of the balance, which changes the balance of forces operating in the two scales. Remember that I posed a question a while ago. Why is it that people who deceive and manipulate have an advantage over people who are honest and transparent? Why is it? Why isn't it all the other way around? You know, why isn't life here on this planet in the societies and cultures of each country and of each continent? Why isn't the life we live together as a human herd characterized by fairness and goodwill and mutual aid and the prospering of people who are honest and transparent with each other, rather than the way it seems to be, which is certainly not that way? Rather, it seems to be that the people who are honest and transparent, the people who of goodwill, who wish well toward others, who would live by the principles of common law, which is to say you're all free to do whatever you want as long as you don't harm anyone else or steal from anyone else or interfere with the rights of another person for no good reason. Okay? Why is it that we're not living that way and that the people who do live that way seem to be on the margin, fighting for a foothold in the system? Whereas the people who cheat, who lie, steal, manipulate, deceive, and corrupt, because they are corrupted, they corrupt everything, those people seem to be running human society. Why is it that way? Why aren't they on the margins? Why aren't those miserable, predatory, psychopathic individuals out there on the margin of society trying to get a foothold rather than at the center where they apparently appear to be calling the shots for the rest of the herd? I ask you to contemplate this question. With this question in mind, we have the background to set up the generalized proposition about moral anarchy. What those of us in this experience would like to see is simply this. We would like to see the odds change so that the odds are in favor of honest, decent, and well-intended people, and the odds are against interspecies predators and the psychopaths who run around in positions of power and influence in this world. Another way to state that is, we would like to see the narrative of truth and the narrative of what is in the human heart that resonates to the aims and purposes of the planetary animal mother preponderate and win over the narrative of deceit. There is a massive narrative of deceit running on this planet. And if you don't see that, you are totally blind. I'm sure many of you see that. I'm sure everyone listening to my words now sees that there's a massive narrative of deceit in every single aspect of life. The 9/11 narrative, the Holocaust narrative. Not to say that there wasn't a terrible genocide committed during the Second World War, and that many people of self-designated Jewish identity were caught up in that. But the version of it sold to the world is a lie. The version of it sold to the world cannot be corroborated by facts. And even the eyewitnesses who repeat that version can be shown to be pretending, which is a terrible, terrifying thing to realize. So the narrative of genocide, the narrative of what is communism, you know, the truth is that communism is a tool of international financiers to redistribute wealth so that they can centralize wealth and power among themselves. But that is not the narrative we hear about communism. The narrative about show business, the narrative about Hollywood, the narrative about our educational system, the narrative about medicine, the narrative about biology, the narrative about science, the narrative about the origin and evolution of the planet Earth. All these narratives are lies, and they are fraudulent. And so what we would like to see is narratives of truth overcoming these narratives of lies. If the balance of forces in the fulcrum, in the scales, changes, if it has been changed by the intervention of the divine Sophia herself, then that is what we might expect to see in the coming 18 months. However, now I'd like to tell you something that is brutally, brutally unavoidable. And it's been a long time that I've wanted to say this and talk about this. So this is a breaking scoop from the Nahual, and I'm giving it to you, my friends and allies, first. And this is a brutal truth that must be faced if we are to take advantage of the change of odds. We cannot just passively go through our lives now wondering about how things are going to change in the grand scheme of things, how the collective and social madness might end when it finally breaks down and we break through the madness back to some sanity. We can't just passively wait. We have to participate. You've got to show up. Freedom is not free. You have to put your life on the line to be free. And I'm going to talk now about how to put your life on the line. The fundamental principle of putting your life on the line is what I call moral anarchy. I can present to you this proposition of moral anarchy, which is the single foundational proposition of Gaian ethics. And I can present it as consisting of four components. The first component is the syntax of the word anarchy. Actually, anarchy means without archons. It comes from the Greek an, the prefix, and an means not, as in anesthetic means not feeling. Aesthesia means to feel. Anesthetic means not feeling. Anarchy means not archy, not archons. It means a world without archons, or to put it in a more accessible and existential language, it means a world without authority. So, anarchy is life, a form of social life without authority. But here I need to correct something, because as soon as this statement is made, even the people who make this statement in favor of anarchy don't know what the fuck they are talking about, because the accusation immediately arises, oh, well, if there is no anarchy, if there is no authority, there is no law. If there is no law, there is no order. And therefore, anarchy is social chaos. Absolutely not. Anarchy is social order without authority dictating the order. An anarchist like myself wants social order. I want an orderly and harmonious society where I can live and thrive and enjoy myself and do whatever the fuck I please, as long as I do not do harm to others in doing so. That's the anarchist creed. But it does not mean chaos and every person for themselves. Because in true anarchy, the order that would otherwise be dictated and enforced by authorities comes from the autonomy of each participating individual. It is order by agreement, not by authority. So social anarchy is the organization of the members of society into an ordered and responsible cooperation by agreements. Everything depends on agreements, and everything falls apart when agreements are broken, or even worse, as I experienced recently in a particular personal intimate situation, an unspoken agreement is a broken agreement. It's not the first time that I've experienced that particular personal tragedy. I also experienced it with someone in 2008 who was an intimate witness to the birth of Planetary Tantra. And with that particular person, the whole show went on the rocks because there was a broken agreement. But since the agreement was not spoken in the first place, it was already broken. So I want you to look at your personal lives. I ask you to look at your personal and intimate lives and to make sure that the agreements that you have with each other are spoken. Because what happens when one individual in relation to another, say they be lovers, they be parent-child, whatever, when one person assumes that there is an agreement that has not been verbally established, then that agreement is already broken by the assumption. So anarchists really like to make agreements, and they like to make them up front and out in the open. And that is the only way that an anarchistic society can survive, by making agreements. So I'm going to come back to this point about agreements in a moment. Obviously, we know we're talking about a mytheme, or a meme, if you will, cognate to the image of the scales. The scales is the image of morality and ethics, which is a system of agreement. Ethics is just a system of agreement. Now let me go to another component of moral alchemy, and that is the moral part. You know, what is moral? What is moral behavior? Are you a moral person, and did you behave morally today? Is John Lash moral? What kind of morals does this guy have? Does he behave morally? You know, what does the word moral mean? Well, moral is just, it doesn't mean shit. There is no inherent code of behavior in the word moral. Moral simply means what is demonstrated by behavior. What is demonstrated by behavior is moral. But there is no code of right or wrong for morals. There is no code established outside the situations in which morals are demonstrated. You see? And this is something, of course, that the right-wing Christians and all people who attach themselves to the horrific illusion that religion gives us the basis of morality. This is something that puts them into deep, deep shock. And let's continue to put them into even deeper shock by reinforcing this truth. Morality is situational, period. There is no absolute frame of morality. You cannot categorically say that it is wrong or immoral to kill a human being. For one human being, for one human animal to kill another, you cannot say that it is categorically or morally or absolutely morally wrong, because it depends on the fucking situation. And this is what many people in this world do not want to hear, and this is one of the truths that now you in this experiment, along with me, shoulder to shoulder, are going to have the courage and the daring to live and manifest to everyone that comes along in every situation that comes along. You know, I was very impressed when I read Jean-Paul Sartre when I was 17 years old, and I had the good fortune to be introduced to his work in a special way through my French teacher at Waldeboro High School in Waldeboro, Maine. And I was profoundly impressed when I heard about an anecdotal conversation in which someone asked Sartre, who was involved in the resistance during the Second World War, the resistance against the Germans, and then there were many stories of heroic resistance, and there were stories of collaboration with the Germans and betrayal of the people who were in the resistance. And Sartre most brilliantly pointed out that the philosophy of existentialism, and especially existential ethics, was formulated in the atmosphere of the resistance. And somebody asked him once, well, you know, did you run into any people? You know, it was a very brave thing to resist the Gestapo and to be in the resistance during the occupation of Paris and so forth. And did you ever run into any people who were cowards? You know, who morally acted as cowards? And Sartre said, without blinking an eye, well, you know, you could be a coward one day and a hero the next day. It's not a label. You cannot essentially be a coward or a hero. You can only be a coward or a hero existentially. Existence precedes essence. You can only be a coward or a hero depending on how you behave in a given situation. And that's morality. So, getting a picture now What is anarchy? It is an order formed by free agreements from the autonomy of each sovereign person. And morality is the code of behavior that is manifested by the way you act in a particular situation. What is your morality? What are your morals? Well, you could say it's what you prove by your behavior. That's all. It's what you prove by your behavior. And if you behave like an anarchist, you stand on your personal autonomy. You stand on your conscience. Your conscience is the only authority in the universe that you can follow. There is no external authority. The realm and rule of the archons is an illusion and a fraud. And the only true morality is the morality of an individual autonomous person. And of course, this is being widely taught now in the free man on land / sovereignty movement and so forth and so on. But there's one huge problem facing the animals of the human collective world before we can move into the right action for this planet and the right action for the human species. And that concerns the illusion of rights. The proper understanding of rights is so essential that without teaching it to children from their early teens when they're able to grasp the concept, there is absolutely no hope whatsoever of building a fair and honest society. And what I'm going to say to you now about rights is something that nobody, for some reason, either realizes, or if they realize it, they don't dare to say it. And here it is. There are no God-given inalienable rights, period. You do not have the inalienable right to breathe. You don't have the right to live, given to you by God or even given to you by the divine Sophia herself. You have the capacity to live, given to you by the divine Sophia out of the substance of this planet. Every time you breathe, she gives you the air to breathe. She gives you the capacity to live, but the right to live is an agreement you share with other people. Now, if you and I are trapped on a desert island and we're only two people left in the world, we both have the capacity to live on that island to the extent that there's air to breathe, there's fresh water to drink, we can fish, we can find things to eat, we can crack open coconuts and drink the milk and eat the white coconut meat. But that has nothing to do with rights. If we are the two people living on this desert island and we make an agreement that I will allow you to live and that you will allow me to live, if we make the agreement that we will not interfere with each other's efforts to live, then we each have the right to live. But it's totally arbitrary. Rights are completely arbitrary. They are assigned by individual members to each other and to the society to which they belong. Period. There are no inalienable rights. And let me tell you something really, really terrible. The predators and the psychopaths have an inordinate advantage over decent people because they know this. They are very clever. And one of the most powerful cards the psychopaths have up their sleeve is that they know that people who go around raising their fists and raising their voices and demanding recognition of the inalienable rights are fools caught in a pathetic and indefensible illusion. Do not be one of those fools. If you commit to moral anarchy, you must also commit to the unwavering realization that the only rights that exist among human beings are rights that are made by free agreement, and that no single person has any inalienable right, and no rights are given by a higher authority, and no rights are given by divine beings, not even the divine Sophia. The assigning of rights is our affair. It is our responsibility. It is our job. And to propose that we claim rights, that we can claim rights because they are assigned to us from some superhuman agency, is a horrible illusion upon which the predators rely for a great deal of their depredation, manipulation, and domination of the human herd. And it is time to absolutely get off it and to use every opportunity that you have to transmit what I am saying now, the understanding of it, to spread the understanding of it to every single person that you can, in every single instance that you can. So dawn is coming up right now, running into 1 hour and 11 minutes here. This is a rather long briefing. I don't want to take it to more than 1 hour and 15. So in setting out for you this proposition of moral anarchy, just let me add one more element. Let me introduce an element that will require a further elaboration as soon as I can get to it. And that is the concept of evil by proxy. Now you recall that we spent a great deal of time pondering the human condition, pondering the social evil in this world during the transit of the lunar apogee before the satanic head of Cetus. We contemplated the ultimate threat to this experiment. We contemplated the different masks of evil, such as Catholicism, Zionism, and so forth. We contemplated the question of evil very deeply. And I'm here to say now that having come out of that excruciatingly difficult exercise in looking into the abyss, as Nietzsche called it, without turning into creatures of the abyss, I'm here to tell you that that was a successful exercise, and that the proof of success is that I now have, with your collaboration, with your support, a syntax of resolution, and that is evil by proxy. And I just want to point out to you, in concluding this talk, something to think about and something to take away with you. What is the difference between the morals of a good person and the morals of an evil person? What is the difference? The difference is very simple. Is that in the morality of an evil person, evil can be committed by proxy. But in the morality of a good person, there is no proxy. Now you can see why, obviously, evil would have an advantage in society. Because one evil person in a community, one evil, corrupt, predatory animal in a herd or community of human animals could spread his or her evil by proxy through other people, and could in effect have other human animals enforcing and enacting its evil for it. But good cannot be achieved by proxy. That is why good is so unique. Try to think of any system in which good things could be done by proxy. You can't. Try to think of a system in which evil can be done by proxy. Well, what is the TSA? I mean, it's so obvious that the TSA is a massive instrument of committing evil by proxy. In fact, government is an instrument of committing evil by proxy. But in moral anarchy, government, as we know it, cannot exist because moral anarchy depends on the performance of good actions, one person at a time, in the autonomy of each person, in a way that cannot be propagated by proxy. That is both the disadvantage of goodness and its supreme power. And the moment to claim, recognize, and claim the supreme power of human goodness is this moment now, is this moment in the completion of Pleromic Relay.